Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The marketplace of ideas. Whether it was thousands of years ago in Athens or now in Chicago and throughout the United States, where people exchange their views and we don't cancel them for things we disagree with. That's what I believe in. And that's what Jeff Carlin believes in here at the Chicago Way podcast and at johncastnews.com. The marketplace of ideas. And one guy who's got some ideas, and I think pretty interesting ones, but I don't know whether he'll ever be able to put them in practice, is Paul Vallis, my friend, commentator, and possible future candidate for mayor. He joins us today, along with Jeff Carlin, as always, executive producer at WGN Radio, lover of cats, baker of pies, and me, John Cass. You see my handsome face on the billboards all around Chicago. Yeah, I'm looking at you at johncassnews.com. And where are you with people voting with their feet in Chicago, with candidates piling in to run for office, not even being able to balance their checkbooks? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, Paul Vallis on the Chicago Way with John Cass and Jeff Carlin. Paul, first of all, there was one Easter this Sunday, another Easter next Sunday. Where are you taking your mom for roast lamb?
Well, as you know, right now, my mom and I are keeping our distance because I got COVID a second time. So unfortunately, we've been communicating over social media. I posted yesterday that it was my mother's birthday on Western Easter, right. and of course she got like a thousand likes and some of the nicest comments. So I was sharing those comments with her, and she was absolutely thrilled. Of course, it was her 93rd birthday, so she's indestructible.
And you're rushing back and forth from Chicago to out there where she is, and you're taking care of her as best you can. But now you can't be around her. So who's taking care of her? Sharon?
Well, of course. And not only my mother, but her parents too. And, you know, so she kind of looks after everybody.
Okay, can we, now that we've done with the niceties,
right?
Can we get to the meat? All right, so here's the thing, Paul. People should know that I've not wanted you to run for mayor. I don't want you to run for mayor. It's not that I don't think you could do the job, because I don't really see anybody else out there. But I don't want your friend, and I don't want you to get hurt by these political weasels who promise money and then they never deliver it. Are you running or what? Are you going to announce or what? What's the deal?
Well, you know, when you've asked me this question before, I've said that if I have the support, if I have the financial support and the infrastructure in place, I'm going to make a run. And right now, I'm very optimistic. I've been connecting with a number of people over the past few months, many who have not supported me before, but I believe will support me this time. And obviously, since the election, because I've been as active as I've been in terms of continuing to talk about the problems that plagued the city, like high crime, like the lack of educational choices, or like the complete financial mismanagement of the city's budget, I've connected with a whole new group of individuals who have never been actively engaged in politics, either organizationally or even financially, and are very interested in me making a run. So I'm very optimistic that we're gonna give it the green light, but I'll make a final decision before Memorial Day.
And Paul, I ask everybody this, but why? I mean, what drives you to want to be the person to fix all the problems and take on such a big responsibility? Because this job is not an easy job.
Well, because the city's in trouble, and I don't see anybody else out there who can do the job. Look, my whole public service career has been being asked to take on major governmental institutions in crisis. The city budget, John, you remember when you were covering the city in the early 90s. The schools, when they were on the verge of financial collapse in 1995, when Philadelphia, when the state took over the Philadelphia public schools, I was likewise asked to go to Philadelphia to help get those schools back in shape. And when Katrina destroyed much of New Orleans and totally devastated the school system, I was asked by senior senator then Mary Landrieu, and of course Mitchell Landrieu, who later on became the mayor of New Orleans, to come to New Orleans to build a brand new school system. And as you know, I've actually spent a lot of time abroad working in international disaster areas like Haiti, and after the devastating earthquake, and then later on in Chile. So this is something that I've always done. But you know, I see the city. This city's on the brink. You know, the post-election budget is going to be an absolute disaster. The mayor has orchestrated a financial crisis that will be unprecedented. Crime is rampant. We are experiencing a crime epidemic, and you know, and the police are voting with their feet. 1,500 police officers have left the city, have left the police department in the last 15 months alone because they're demoralized. They feel undersupported. They're being managed with the most abusive work schedules. Their days being canceled. Them being sometimes at the spur of the moment put on 12-hour work shifts. And of course, the schools are an absolute disaster. The schools are in a free fall. They've lost 25,000 students in the last 2 years alone. Incidentally, during that same period, they've increased their budget by 21%. I mean, parents are fleeing the district in droves, so it's a disaster.
Speaking of schools, as Jeff knows, there was a column this week, early in the week, on johncastnews.com, written by Paul Vallis, in which he accuses the teachers' unions nationally of supporting institutional racism by not giving parents school choice. And here's a quote. "They shamelessly let the kids bear the brunt of the pandemic while gaslighting the public as they wrap themselves in the flag of progressive movement. Preserving a broken status quo is by definition antithetical to progress." Paul Vallis is accusing the teachers' unions nationally, and I suppose that also applies locally to the Chicago Teachers Union. Is that a sound political beginning?
Well, you know, I'm always going to tell it like it is. Bottom line is education is the civil rights issue for this generation. And the fact remains that these teacher union dominated large urban school districts are institutionally racist, not by design or not by intent, I should say, but by outcome. because they deny children educational choice. Parents, the quality of a child's school depends on their geography and depends on their income. And the unions have worked overtime to try to limit or block or stifle educational choice, even public school choice. You see it in the Chicago public schools, where the union got the wimpy school board in the last contract negotiations to agree to cap the creation of new charters and to actually cap enrollment in public charter schools. So the union has been working overtime to maintain its monopoly, and it's to the detriment of all the children, particularly children who come from who are part of poor families, who do not have the financial means to, in effect, secure any other educational choices. This is institutional racism, if there ever has been, and well, you know, I'm, or to the greatest degree. And I think what needs to happen is we finally need to give parents the power to determine, to select the best school for their child. We need to provide parental choice. Parents need to be able to pick the best school, whether it's a charter school or a parochial school or a private school. There's no compromise. There's no accommodation choice short of parental choice that will begin to break this stranglehold, this monopoly. The second thing is we need to empower communities to be able to select better school models. Right now, if you have a failing school in a poor inner city community, even that local school council has no ability to change that school, has no ability to demand a better school model. In cities like Indianapolis and Denver and other cities, they are actually empowering the community to request and to demand better school models for their failing schools. Your readers and your listeners can Google them. They're called innovation schools and renaissance schools, and they've had tremendous success. So we need to provide both parents with the ability to choose the best school for their child, and we need to provide the financial support to enable that choice to be exercised. And we need to empower the community when they have a failing school in that community. We need to empower the parents, the local school councils in that community to select a better model for their failing school.
So let's apply some Chicago Way metrics and logic to this. 100,000, at least 100,000 Black families have left the city in the past 10 years. Most of them left because of poor public education. What remains are the parents who, you know, have been weakened by circumstance, by whatever, and they're just trapped in the system. Meanwhile, the Chicago, what is the main shopping district in Chicago? The Michigan Avenue. And the Water Tower Place has just turned over its keys to its bankers, basically saying, we're done. So what happens to the city as a whole, and the suburbs as a whole, if we don't improve or let parents who are remaining improve education? What happens to the entire region and the city of Chicago?
Well, you can see what's happening right now. You can see what's happening on the west side and the south side, where you have and incidentally, obviously these problems and these challenges are being spread throughout the city. You have two fundamental problems in Chicago, besides the fact that this is a government that's never satisfied, and it seems hell bent on spending and on taxing us more. And I mean, the city has the highest property taxes among big cities in the country and the highest sales taxes. And I believe that the fees and fines that we impose dwarf those of any other large American city. So we're just devastating people financially. But let me point out that crime and failing schools is driving the middle class away from the city. And it's leaving poor people who don't have the means to finance quality schools, or don't have the means to move, to find safer neighborhoods or to a healthier community, They're literally hostages in their communities. And that exodus, John, over the last 20 years, that exodus of Black families, that exodus has been, I believe it's 255,000 overwhelmingly Black middle income families with children. So it's had a devastating consequence. So the failure to ensure that these communities are safe and our strategy has made these communities less safe rather than more safe. The strategy of abandoning community policing, of pulling cops from neighborhood beats, of not providing for witness protection programs, of restraining proactive policing, that has had devastating consequences in the poorest communities, in the communities that have experienced the highest crime. It's had devastating consequences citywide, but those communities have become even more dangerous. And today in the city of Chicago, this was pre-COVID. WBEZ did a report that said only 16% of the city's population is currently considered to be middle income. And, you know, when I graduated high school in 1970, a half century ago, 50% of the city was middle income. And that is a disaster. That will have disastrous consequences because we are rapidly becoming a tale of two cities. And unless we address the issue of public safety aggressively, and unless we address the issue of failing schools, we're going to continue to see this city deteriorate. The bottom line is we keep on electing people who just have who are totally incompetent. Look, we have people. We have a mayor who, I mean, you might have not. You certainly wouldn't have hired to run your business, let alone if she has ever started a business. The bottom line is we continue to elect people who are politicians and not managers. And they will know how to balance the budget if you gave them an 8-year course in the subject. You know, our cities are consistently run by individuals who you would be reluctant to hire to run your own business operation. So we see it. We see it reflected in their budget plans. You know, the mayor has now submitted and passed 3 consecutive budgets that were structurally imbalanced, significantly structurally unbalanced, continuing the same practices of Rahm Emanuel about deferring obligations. And in the past 2 years, this is during COVID, the past 2 years during COVID, in which her COVID mitigations strangled the city's economy and stifled its revenue growth, she increased spending over 60% with no corresponding increase in permanent revenues. That's a disaster. Now it's election year, so she's come out with all these progressive programs and things like that. And because it's an election year, and of course, none of these programs will be sustainable post-election. And so what you've seen is the continued irresponsible budgeting that characterized her predecessor. Do you realize, John, that despite the $6 billion that has been received during COVID, both the city and the schools in combination have increased property taxes in well over $500 million. And that includes the property taxes that go up when the tax increment financing program shifts more money away from the tax base and into these developmental funds that the mayor has exclusive control over. So the bottom line is, despite $6 billion in COVID, despite these devastating COVID mitigations that have punished businesses and have punished working families, they still have found it necessary to increase property taxes by well over $500 million.
Yeah, but that's management, budget, facts. You're talking facts. You're trying to warn people. And really, I think what they care about is feelings. People want feelings, Paul. You don't understand this. They want to Twitter back and forth to each other that they're progressive or they care. And they're not interested in that. And at the same time that they get engaged in feelings rather than management, the business community has known this problem for decades and has not yet given you the money to run a real campaign and separate you from other pretenders like I don't know, Baby Kangaroo, Mike Quigley, you know, John Catanzara, who thinks he can be mayor after the things he said at Chicago Police, and other candidates. And I just think, as I've said before to you in private, I should tell people in public what I've said. You should just walk away and say, hey, big business guys, enjoy your city. You know, I'm not going to kill myself to save you.
Well, look, you know, I'm not trying to pretend that I'm the savior of anything. You know, I'm a problem solver, and that's what I've done all my life. And I did it with the scandal ridden revenue department in 1990 when I first came to Chicago, and when the city had a severe crisis, budget crisis in 93, and of course taking over schools. I mean, this is what I do. This is what I love, and it has pained me to see now. You know, as I am in my fourth decade of public service, to see things far worse than they have ever been. The fact is simple. We live in the most violent city in the country. And let me point out that anyone who says, well, New York has seen an increase in violent crime in LA. Guess what? The murder rate, the jump in the murder rate in New York is equal to about 25-30% of the murder rate during the peak crime years in the 70s and in the 90s, you know, when you had the cocaine wars. It's the same thing with L.A. Our murder rate is at 75-80% of what it was in those, in those record years in the 90s when you had the cocaine wars. You know, we had 58 mass shootings last year. We had 10% of the mass shootings in the entire country. The bottom line is we live in the most violent city, the most violent big city in the country, with one of the worst school systems in the nation. And yet we pay the highest property taxes, the highest sales taxes, the highest fees and fines. There is something wrong with this picture. There is something wrong with this picture. And the next mayor, whether it's me or someone else, has got to be somebody who has the ability, who not only has a vision for the city, but knows how to implement that vision and has the courage to implement the vision. And we've got to elect somebody who knows how to manage what is in essence a $26 billion enterprise. The mayor controls $26 billion in spending. That's the city, the schools, the airports, the CTA, the CHA, you know, the park district, the city colleges. $26 billion is spent every year under the direction or either directly or indirectly under the control of the mayor. That's close to 100,000 jobs. And for heaven's sakes, we need to get somebody who has done more in their history than simply manage a legislative office. So we need to not only elect somebody who has articulated a vision for the city. And what I've been doing the last 3 years since that election is I've continued to comment on issues of public safety, on issues of school, on issues of finance. We need to not only identify somebody who's been totally transparent on what he or she feels the city needs to do to get on the right track, but somebody who has managed multi-billion dollar enterprises in crisis and somebody who has the courage to do what is needed to get this city back on track.
Jeff, do you think this sounds like a candidate for mayor of Chicago?
It certainly does. I was laughing, Paul, when you were listing off the things the city doesn't have or taxes as hard. We pay the most for all this. And we have the crappiest roads, too. Don't forget that. What I wanted to ask you, you know, one of the things we discussed on this podcast recently was the idea of citizenship for officers. And you have a good finger on the pulse of police in this city at times. What do you think about that idea that if we relax citizenship rules and requirements for officers, and I would assume teachers as well, which probably seems disastrous in my opinion, but
you mean illegal immigrants as cops? Is that what you're saying?
Not
on the podcast I'm associated with? Okay.
No. Citizenship requirement for the city of Chicago.
Well, let me respond because what you're talking about is the mandatory residency rule city employees. All right. You know, the city council, you know, anyone who advocates for that knows full well that'll never happen because the city council will never vote for it. And they will never vote for it because they know right now, John, 16% of the city is middle income. Okay, 16%. If you eliminated that tomorrow, it would drop to 6 or 7%. In other words, this city would be
overnight
overwhelmingly poor and low income, and most of the remaining middle class would vanish. So the city council, if you wanted to do it, you were hell bent, or you wanted to make it a priority. When you say that, that may appeal to rank and file city workers, but at the end of the day, it's not going to happen because the city council is simply never going to support it. Period.
The these are all fascinating arguments, Paul. And again, I just point out that the political class, the political donor class in this city, is corrupt because they haven't, you know, come to you. They kissed the dailies behind and all these other people, Roms, but not you. And I wonder why. But here's another problem. You're not a minority. I know when you were born and a small wee lad, as I was in the city of Chicago, Greeks were a minority. And in some cases, they didn't think, particularly in some of the Irish Catholic parishes, and even though there are brothers and sisters in many things, they didn't think we were all that white. And now you're going to be accused, if you run, of being the white guy in the race. How do you deal with that?
Oh, you know, I think there's going to be a fringe who do that. You know, a lot of people are going to look. I have always, you know, I have always in every city that I've worked, I've had responsibility for institutions that were overwhelmingly minority in that in terms of not only the individuals who worked for me, but also obviously the population I served. All my schools have been schools that have been that have served overwhelmingly minority and low income families. And I've always thrived. Look, when I ran against Rob Blagojevich and challenged the party leadership back in 2001, I almost won. I mean, I beat him in the city and I did extremely well in the suburbs. If I had a fraction of the money that he had had, I easily would have gotten elected. So the bottom line is, I think, look, people say, well, what's your tribe? You know, they always want to put us in tribes.
The city of tribes.
What's your constituency? Yeah. This is my constituency. My tribe or my constituency is anyone who wants a safe city. That means a safe city for everybody, a safe city for every family, a safe city for every community. My tribe is anyone who wants parental choice, unabashed. Chicago Teachers Union, I'm coming for 100% school choice, period. The bottom line is my tribe or my constituency is anyone who believes that we simply should not be the highest tax, the highest fine, and, you know, and the highest feed district city in the nation. My tribe is anyone who believes that we should not have this imperialistic mayor, but rather we should have a system of government where we have a functioning city council that can at least has a voice and at least can serve as a check on the imperial mayor who's able to tell us how we're going to spend our $26 billion that the mayor's office actually controls either directly or indirectly, or how the $1 billion that we skim off our property taxes to finance these tax increment financing projects are being spent. So that's my tribe. My tribe are people who believe in a safe city, people who believe in quality schools, people who believe that we need to end the tax and waste spending policies that have characterized not only this administration, but past administrations.
Well, that sounds like you should take that and put it, if you run, put it in a campaign commercial. Because, you know, I'd be impressed by that. Again, everyone listening, Paul's a friend of mine. We've been friends for a long time. I remember when he was budget director for the city of Chicago, and the Mayor Daley's alderman would come over and say, hey, you know, quietly say, hey, what's with your Greek friend? He's asking the mayor about all the salt that we're buying from Melrose Park. What's with your Greek friend? Doesn't he understand? And I would say, Paul, you know, take care of this. I don't want you to, I don't, as I said to Ray Lopez the other day, I don't want, you know, I didn't want a car to come to you. Hey, Paul, we'll take you for dinner at Chinatown at midnight, spaghetti dinner at 11:30 or something. I didn't want to see that happen because I just don't know if, you know, in the city of fools that want feelings and they think about identity politics and who's this and who's that and what tribe you represent, they're not interested in management. They're not interested in long-term stability. They're just interested in tribes, whether those tribes wear kilts and play bagpipes, whether the tribes wear sombreros, whatever the tribe wears. And, of course, the city of Chicago, feelings don't matter. Facts matter. The bottom line matters. And people vote with their feet. But, Paul, we want to thank you very much for being here. And let's see if you come back after Memorial Day, right?
Memorial Day.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, Paul. Thanks for having me.
All right. For Paul Vallis, whether he gets the money or not to run, he's still got ideas. And we'll see about Memorial Day, whether he'll be running in the mayoral campaign, the main event, as people in Chicago keep voting with their feet and leaving town. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, future physics teacher, the ginger-bearded baker and lover of cats, and my friend, and Jeff, we got to talk next time about how I'm going to cook this lamb. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com, your favorite website for policy and politics. Thanks for joining us. And join us again, won't you, for another edition of The Chicago Way on WGN+.